first sworn statement, the witness is on the stand for the first time under oath, and let's say on his direct examination, regardless whether it's the state's witness or defense witness, but in direct examination, he lied.
Get tired.
So then on cross-examination, if he then, when you start pointing out facts to him on cross-examination, that finally he comes across and tells the truth. I mean, he hasn't, that wouldn't really be a recanting. He's now given another sworn statement. First he said he was there, and then he said he wasn't, after admitted on cross-examination he wasn't. Well, there you've got the two sworn statements right there, one on direct and one on cross-examination. And he's guilty of perjury, whether he was there or not.
Well, let me try. Can I make a point?
Take one last shot at it.
All right.
I think I have no interest in protecting the perjurer, absolutely, or hoping that he'll see the light and come across. And I think it comes down to this. Do we want the law to say to the one who is about to commit perjury, go ahead and commit perjury, or as Harl says, let's think the other way around first. If you're going to lie, be consistent, because if you cross up, we're going to nail you.
That's what the law is right now.
All right. Or do we want to say, and let me say coolly what the law will say if Harl says, go ahead and lie. And if it looks like they're getting close, you've got a chance to change it if the DA gets breathing down your neck. And I think that's the philosophical question. Because the truth is what we're after, and I ask you, which is better serves the truth?
And a comment on that would be that the...
Hooray! Those who are believed, stand up now and come to the front!
Our right to defend is charged in that trial, more important to come out of that. And that maybe this perjurer goes free, but that the truth as to that defendant come out at that time, and the witness goes free for his perjury, or that we say, we're going to make it tough for you to tell the truth here, that you better be consistent.
Is perjury a question of past tense or future tense? Do you want to stop perjury or do you want to punish it? And I say we're going to stop it.
He may prove subsequently that he committed perjury. It would be awful hard to unring that bell of conviction.
Well, I said I don't always say
that. Perjury more often a problem than civil action.
No, I don't think so.
Very soon.
Can we take
unofficial show of hands of attitude of the commission on proposing
Harl, this is what I was going to say. You brought this up now because this is a section, because you said this is a section on defenses, and if we were going to put in a defense, we'd put it in here. But this section contains no defenses. This section points out three specific instances, as we've amended it, which provide that these instances don't constitute a defense. Now, the thing about which we've been talking for the last half an hour could still be urged as a defense. As a matter of fact, if a jury could buy it, couldn't it?
Not a defense now.
No. But just because we don't have it in a statute as a defense doesn't mean that a jury wouldn't let a guy off the hook if his attorney could successfully argue.
Anyway.
The jury always makes law.
The defendant testifies, yes, that's right.
Would you want to defend on that if you were defending?
Oh, in theory, you're right, John, but as a practical matter, I don't think any competent defense lawyer would adopt that as strategy.
All right.
Why would you think?
All right. Well, let's have a show of hands. How many favor Harl's suggestion that we have this as an affirmative defense? Is that all right?
I'm sure we could work on the language of whether or not.
Let me clarify something in my very non-legal mind. Wouldn't you accomplish the same thing by defeating Section 7?
Oh, I think Section 7 is the guts of your whole argument.
Oh, they're really two separate problems.
Yeah, in his book, but all seven very occurrences say if he's been inconsistent under oath.
No prosecuting.
Well, it just says that's all you got to prove.
You're not saying the DA isn't put in the dilemma of having to decide which one is a false statement. One of them is false. You're not going to make the DA prove which one and be thrown out of court.
I want to lock it up after we take the vote on the motion in front of us. So let's have a show of hands, Frank. How many favor this as an affirmative defense? One, two, three, four.
Favor of Harl's again?
Yeah, as an affirmative defense. One, two, three, four, five.
I am so moved.
Now, wait a minute.
You got five.
Well, I think you've got some drafting to do. You've got several models.
Is it the wish of the commission that we send Section 5 back to the staff to redraft it, or that we approve Section 5 as the motion is before us and work on the defense as part of redrafting Section 7?
I think we ought to approve Section 5 and ask the staff to return an addendum on the additional section, additional subsection.
I think if you're going to have a retraction section, it should be a separate section.
Yeah, I do too.
A separate section. All right, then the motion is to approve Section 5 as amended. All in favor, say aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk can read the roll.
Judge Bruce?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Fox?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. And Commissioner Clark moves that the staff be directed to draft a new separate section on retractions as a defense. Everybody in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
So all your funds lie?
Okay.
No.
That's it.
Adjourn? I have Tunnel Irrigation District's most members that we should at least enter into a discussion as to whether or not we should include in the criminal code revision the matter relating to narcotics and drugs. Do you want to take off on that?
Yes. Now, this was subcommittee number three, Judge Burns' subcommittee, where we discussed this last week. And we really didn't get into the draft as such, but the question was brought up, particularly due to the fact that the legislature just last session spent a great deal of time in this area and passed some rather important new legislation with respect to narcotics and dangerous drugs, that before we went any further with our work in this area, we should get a reading from the members of the commission. And all of you should have received copies of some introductory material that we sent out to you earlier this week relating to present law and the background of what has been done recently in the legislature, and also proposing four alternative approaches in this area. And as we mentioned in the subcommittee, there may be other approaches. These are all we could think of with respect to the decision as to what, if anything, the commission should do in this area. Now, with that in mind, I think perhaps Judge Burns, the chairman of the subcommittee, might make some comments.
Before Jim does that, could you tell us what was the extent to which the 69 legislature went in this field? You had it in that memo.
Yes. Now, this was House Bill 1838. And the effect of that legislation, which was passed in 1969, was that ORS 475.625, prohibiting a person from using or being under the influence of drugs, was amended to include dangerous drugs. It formerly had applied only to narcotic drugs. ORS 475.635, the penalty provision for ORS 475.625 was amended by deleting the mandatory 90-day jail sentence. Violation of that statute is a misdemeanor. 475.990 sub 2 is the penalty section for relating to ORS 475.100, and this prohibits the sale and possession of dangerous drugs. And subsection 2 therein was amended by increasing the penalty. The maximum fine was increased from $200 to $5,000, while the maximum jail sentence was increased from 6 months to either 1 year or 10 years. Penalty section 474.020 sub 1, which prohibits the sale or possession of narcotics. The penalty section that relates thereto, which is 474.990 sub 2, was amended to reduce the penalty for possession or sale of marijuana from a felony to an indictable misdemeanor. Now, I think that's pretty much the effect of House Bill 1838.
Judge Burns. The four basic approaches, or four basic things that we could do, are set forth on page 2, and essentially they are as follows. One is to revise the criminal law applicable to narcotics and dangerous drugs, and put it in the criminal code. And there, as much as possible, we would attempt to avoid any what might be called substantive changes, at least with respect to the penalty structure that was put in this last session, and leave the regulatory provisions in Chapter 474 and 475, so that what you would have would be, insofar as society attempts to react to the narcotic problem in a criminal manner, this would be in the criminal code in language and style and so forth, consistent with our overall revision, and then leave the purely regulatory aspects in the later chapters. The second alternative would be to incorporate chapters 474 and 475 into our revised criminal code and make only structural changes and perhaps some minor wording changes to conform with our overall style. Third would be to leave both criminal and regulatory phases of drug problems in 474 and 475, and simply amend the penalty provisions in those chapters to conform with the penalty provisions that we ultimately expect to end up with in the revised criminal code. And the fourth alternative is to just do nothing. Just leave 474 and 475 where they are and not even make any structural or language changes or even any revisions in the penalty structure. And those are the four possible alternatives. And I think really because Dave Frost spoke quite strongly to this, I think really he ought to give you his notions on it, because it was because of his suggestion that we brought it directly to the full commission, rather than with the thought in mind that if the full commission essentially adopted his point of view, then it didn't make any sense for the subcommittee to spend a lot of time going over the crossing the T's and dotting the I's in the revision. So, I'm not trying to put Dave on the spot, but he was the one who...
But you've done that.
Yes, I've done it. Accidentally, you've done it pretty well.
He voiced it as strong, more strongly than the other members of the subcommittee. And
so that doesn't play, you should do what they can do.
My angling on it was that the, during the 69 session, we spent a great deal of time, at least we did in the House Judiciary, I don't know that the Senate met on the problem, but we spent a great deal of time on the drug problems. It's a bad one.
It's going to be a year of subsidy.
Yeah. Burns a new year going to hell.
But Jake will recall, and other House members, or Senators, that we heard testimony all over the country, with people down screaming and shouting. We had at least two hearings, as I recall, in room 6 with crowds. And it was a rather difficult law of mourning, but it was born. The wisdom of our approach, I think, has been borne out since President Nixon has now adopted the Oregon approach to drug problems. And I think at this point it would be not the Republicans. I hope you didn't hear that. I think at this point it would be very difficult for us and rather unpopular, and I think unwise, to try to redo a law that we've recently done, which apparently has very good acceptance from judges, according to our system chairman. A change about which I've heard nothing but good from other lawyers in this office. Now, I think it would be probably better for us also, on my approach, is to do nothing. It's a courageous approach. And to do it exactly where it is now, while we say in number four that it's left outside the criminal code, it's left outside the criminal code substantively, it's left outside procedure, which we're talking about, not putting it physically in with the criminal code section. But I think our best bet at this point is to leave it exactly as it is and let it mellow for a couple of years and then make that a subject of an additional study by a bill through the legislature in 2 or 4 or 6 years if it seems necessary. But even if we change it structurally to make it fit in with our approach to other substantive crimes, we're going to get into the area of change, penalties. Are we going to use degree? Are we going to use sale as a separate crime in possession? There's a lot of testimony it's very difficult to make sales case. Are we going to, when we get into the degrees by penalty, we'll have to then structure the type of crime we're talking about, and this is the exact problem we had so much trouble with in the last session, is how do you structure these things to put a separate penalty? I don't know for all of the discussion we went through, but my feeling is the best thing is just leave alone. From a political standpoint also, I think that if we make many changes, we're going to get all those people who were so upset before upset again. And this time they're going to be aiming at the entire criminal code revision rather than one separate bill. So my suggestion is, as I say, to take the greatest approach embodied in sub 4.
Judge Burns, who was it that advocated the placement of this in the criminal code?
Well, actually, what Roger had drafted, Roger had drafted the proposed language, which would be number one, and before we even got to it, he had put this as a preliminary material. Before we even got to it, why this question arose, and I must say I disagree with Dave on his view. I favor number one. I think it ought to be in the criminal code. I think that not just from a structural standpoint, but simply recognition that narcotics presents two areas of problems. One is as it affects criminal penalties and criminal procedure and so on. The other as it as the regulatory phases, like anything else, pharmacy and so on. I think that we ought to just face up to the problem, and the actual revision that Roger suggested isn't very great, but I say that not as defer to Dave here, because I didn't go through all those long, terrible problem hearings and so on, and so I don't appreciate those problems like he does, but I don't think that basically the changes would be that significant. And I think we ought to, it's part of the criminal law. Our job is to revise, restructure, simplify, and so on, the whole criminal code, and I think it belongs in there. Now, I must say that really what Dave is getting down to is a practical, realistic, political aspects of the problem, and I must say I'm not nearly as able to judge those as he is, so I just don't know. But I think we ought to adopt number one. I think it's part of the criminal law. It ought to be in the criminal code. We ought to take it out of 474, and with some restructuring and some changes, but basically I wouldn't think they'd be significant changes. Leave it, put it in the criminal code, but basically retain the penalty structure that was worked out in 1838 of having both dangerous drugs and narcotics, either sale or possession, be felony misdemeanor options. Possibly with some degrees if you have a sale to minors and a sale of unusual quantities and so on. So I believe we ought to go the route of number one.
John?
Lee?
On the Dangerous Drug Act, you have changes you made by administrative action to create a balance. Has anybody looked into the problem? This is no other reason. I was thinking for one reason why we ought to take one provision. Also, I think the fact you've got two acts, if that makes sense, they should be consolidated. So I didn't figure.
Frank?
These belong in the criminal statutes, not off somewhere. I think it'd be well as long as we're changing our wording and the definition of terms, it should be consistent to not have the narcotics, the dangerous drugs off in some other area. This commission really hasn't been too hesitant to stick its foot in the water and like sex and sanity and pass it and see why drugs should be any different. So I feel we should go ahead.
Dave, let me ask you a question. What if the substance remains the same, what makes you think that we would create a lot of problems and have all of the same people here? If in effect, as Judge Burns says, what we place in the criminal code is, except for perhaps changes in wording or structural changes, the same thing that exists in 1838.
For example, Tony, it's probably in the area of degrees of crime. We're using degrees everyplace else. We have degrees of possession, for instance. As I recall, Roger, the draft talks about quantity of drugs sold.
2 degrees.
2 degrees. And this, while we may not call this a substantive change, this is a subject over what we've spent a great deal of time. You may have the classic man in the Italian silk suit hanging around schools who actually has 5 kilos of hash in his car, and he's caught only selling one joint of marijuana to a kid. Now, that probably falls within 1 degree, a separate degree. You don't have a latitude in sentencing, a latitude in treating him that you would have under a present law.
Why couldn't we handle that differently?
Pardon?
Why couldn't we put this in the criminal code and still not adopt the degree deal and leave the penalties and sentences?
That would be, if we don't adopt my do-nothing approach, we'd love to have that label. My second suggestion would be that we simply transfer it from 474 and 475 and put it into the criminal code. But once you start talking about degrees, and once you separate sale and possession, and once you talk about quantities, you're right back in the trap that we spent so much time with last session. Now, it's difficult to say what we are going to do because we haven't done anything yet. But if we made it strictly non-substantive, all procedural transference physically from one part of the code to another, then I wouldn't get upset. Except that you're putting it back into revision to send through.
One, you shouldn't have two separate acts. One, there's no reason to call one a narcotic, one a dangerous drug. And secondly, the administrative procedure in there is all screwed up. And I think there is a question in my mind of whether we really shouldn't. We're going to elevate a dangerous drug to a felony, whether you shouldn't follow the procedure we used to as much as I should have actually designated the drugs from the statute and have two separate crimes. One for those that are designated in the statute and one for those that have to be designated during the interim by administrative agency,
but
I think
you've
got a problem.
Well, I just agree that you should have a problem accepting this.
The drugs seem to be in popularity and become more readily available more often than the legislature needs. So.
No, what I'm saying, Bob, is you've got to have two separate classifications, possibly. I'm not sure if you have a problem with a felony out of the administrative rule.
Well, the situation exists elsewhere where administrative agencies have changed their penalties pretty substantially.
Well, although Roger has a proposed
draft on the narcotic dangerous drugs forum. The subcommittee didn't go into it at all because we got into this discussion and wanted the commission to give us some direction. But I think really all we need to know is he wants to look at it all and then go through the subcommittee and look at the proposed changes and decide whether we feel it should be.
That's my feeling, and I think it does belong in the criminal code, but I think there's a great deal of merit in what Dave Frost had said, that we would stir up the old ghosts. And in light of the work that was done and the acceptance of 1838, I think the subcommittee and the commission should bear in mind that they should do as little violence to that as possible. But I do feel it belongs in the criminal code.
So, Chairman, I would write a motion. Send it back to the committee and they incorporate it into the criminal code.
Which of the four options? Number
well,
one?
Well, I wouldn't make the.
Make that determination later.
All right.
Is there any further discussion?
Question.
Well,
could
I yes.
amend Lee's motion? And that is with the direction of the commission to the subcommittee that what is presently chapters 474 and 475 be incorporated into the criminal code. Without doing substantial violence to the changes made in 69.
Same type of option, number two. You're limiting it to.
The substantive changes regarding penalties.
Well, I'm trying to get from that.
Okay, number two is what I'm talking about.
Well, except that number two, as worded, would bring in the regulatory phases as well, and I don't really think we ought to do that. And I don't really believe that Dave thinks so either. But he's fighting a rear guard action at the moment.
Well, actually his statement or his motion to amend to do as little violence as possible for that, I think leaves considerable leeway to the subcommittee work on it. You accept that amendment?
I'll accept that amendment.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
We're all on record as being against violence.
Yes.
We've all decided that drugs are not only a social problem.
Mr. Chairman, I would further move that this, the narcotics and dangerous drugs be given as subcommittee number one.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think you can do that without the chairman of the subcommittee here.
A call from Wilsonville, driving a 1948 automobile, which took a long time to get here.
What insurance did he
He said he'd be right back.
Oh.
He's labor and management are meeting
off.
I'm
hoping he's good back here. I got a point or two I need to learn on today. Wait for the Clark to show up.
Well, you've got Spalding.
Yeah.
Don, which you or Roger are going in for perjury?
Well, I should mention, Mr. Chairman, just to bring people up to date on the last commission meeting, we got through the first five sections of our perjury draft. But also, we discussed and the commission voted to send it back to the staff with respect to a section allowing a retraction. The subcommittee originally had not included such a provision, although it had been discussed. So that would appear as section six. So this would be the first order of business, I think, with respect to perjury. Roger has drafted a section on retraction, which I think fulfills the general direction of the motion that was approved by the commission regarding it. So Roger would probably want to go ahead and explain what he's done in this area, I think.
Well, I'll read the section for section six, perjury and false swearing, retraction. It is a defense to any prosecution for perjury or false swearing that the defendant retracted his false statement in the course of the same proceeding in which it was made. Statements made in separate hearings at separate stages in the same judicial or administrative proceeding shall be deemed to have been made in the course of the same proceeding. The second sentence is just used to somewhat clarify what we mean by the term in the course of the same proceeding.
I'd like to.
In the course of the proceedings, that if somebody comes back guilty, the defendant stands up and says, "Judge, rather than put jail for perjury, I'll tell you I lied."
Thanks, Carl.
Well, in the sentencing hearing, it'd be part of the same, in a separate hearing, the same thing. If you got out of the sentencing, they will be now, I'm sorry.
Is that what we're trying to do?
That would be a very good time. As I understand.
After the sentencing.
As I understand proceedings, criminal proceedings, judicial proceedings, criminal, this would start, in any given case, would start with the grand jury and go clear through to the sentencing.
According to the second sentence, I guess.
Well, there are two diametrically opposed views on this type of statute in the United States, what they term the federal and the New York rule, and I'd like to read something here that kind of focuses on the policy situations behind that. This is out of 64 ALR section 276. The difference, now the federal rule does not allow retraction. Where what they term the New York rule, New York has had a retraction statute for many years prior to this recent revision. The difference between the federal and New York rule may perhaps be explained by a difference in judicial policy. The federal rule requires a witness to testify truthfully at all times and subjects him to punishment for perjury if he intentionally falsifies his record without regard for any change of heart for the witness, on the theory that to do otherwise is to encourage false swearing. The policy behind the New York rule, however, seems to be that it is highly important that the tribunal receiving the testimony know the truth. And as a means of achieving this end, it may be wise to encourage even one who willfully testifies falsely to come forward with the truth so that justice may be done. Under the New York rule, the recantation must be prompt and must come before harm has been done to the inquiry underway and before the witness has learned that his falsehood has been discovered by others. But even under the new federal rule, recantation may be effective to show an absence of criminal intent on the part of the witness offering false testimony. And they comment that these, it may well be that these two rules achieve the same result, since even under the federal rule, they do, retraction would be allowed to show lack of criminal intent, and that the practical results may be somewhat the same. The most recent case in the United States, the 1968 Texas case, Butler versus State, and this involved an attorney who was convicted of subornation of perjury. They rejected the New York rule, stating, appellant would have this court follow the New York rule, which is clearly in the minority, and hold that since Hansen, who was the witness, recanted while still on the stand, the crime of perjury was not committed. We have concluded to the contrary and follow the federal majority rule, which is that if a witness intended to commit perjury, no manner of recanting will absolve him. This retraction was made in this trial within half an hour of the cross-examination.
Perjury is perjury, I think. And the prosecutor would take it into consideration, so would the grand jury, to whether or not to indict. I have promptly recanted. I'm not saying it might not indict, but certainly it wouldn't be influenced by it. It just doesn't seem to me to make sense to say that even though he intentionally, deliberately committed perjury, if half an hour later he admits it and says, "I'm sorry," he hasn't committed a crime. He has.
Bruce, come on. What we're principally concerned with is, let's say he's not the defendant in the trial, which is this statute places a premium on final truth in that trial and he delivers, giving justice to that defendant in that trial. It seems to me that you've been faced with it, with consistency is a great reward. Lied and he let it be known by God your testimony. You said this under oath, and you better hang with that story.
because if you know, and if you're a defendant sitting there, put the witness in the case, or if he's going to tell the truth, he's going to go to jail.
Yeah, you're talking now about the effect on somebody else besides society in general and the accused prisoner.
Well, seems what the proposition is, are we most interested in arriving at the unvarnished truth in a given procedure? Or are we most interested in saying that you can't lie under oath? Period. It seems if you let a guy defend himself from a charge of perjury by telling the truth, he's likely at some, more likely, not likely, more likely at some stage in the proceedings to be willing to admit that he lied in the first place.
Yeah, at that stage of the proceedings when somebody's got the goods on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, doesn't that, even if that's the case, when somebody's got the good end, haven't we served in that particular proceeding, haven't we best served the cause of the process, which is to arrive at a decision based on facts, not on lies?
The courts have quite consistently held, I think, that you're not entitled to a new trial after a verdict and judgment, because some material witness admits they lied. And that would have made a difference. Thinking of the court says that it was up to the jury in the first place to weigh the quality and truth of the evidence, and they did that.
But I'd add to that, however, we also have the line of cases that if there's been knowing falsification in the criminal proceeding known to the prosecution, they'll set aside those convictions.
Oh yeah, because the prosecution didn't give the defendant the benefit, but that's a different
Well, sure, you've got the added factor in there.
What about this thought of meaning that I think it should, because I think last time the doctor, at least one of the proposals, they said as long as you've got two diametrically opposed statements under oath, the state doesn't have to pick which one is the truth and prove that it's the truth. So you'd almost come down to the point that if there weren't a retraction statute where before an attorney started cross-examining a witness, the court would have to advise him that whenever he was asked, well, now isn't it really this other way, he didn't have to answer that question when he can't incriminate.
Well, we haven't gotten to that section.
Because if he comes across in cross-examination, he'll be incriminating. The defendant would have his attorney there as a witness.
Cross-examination unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Has New York had any problem with this question of the recantation prior to it becoming manifest that the falsification would be exposed?
No, but there are very few cases. That's been fairly narrowly construed. It's rather difficult for a defendant to take advantage of the New York statute the way it's drawn. That's why I have not included the model penal code language here. This follows the Michigan approach.
Going farther than New York and the model penal code.
Yes.
In that it eliminates those features.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a question to make sure that I understand the section. If the wording is, it is a defense. Now, we've used this wording in other sections, and I wonder if this means the burden of proof is on the defendant, or what is the intent?
Well, the model for this proposed amendment, Michigan section 4930, and there the last sentence in this section states the burden of injecting the issue of retraction is on the defendant, but this does not shift the burden of proof, and that's what we mean.
Yeah.
By stating as a defense rather than an affirmative defense, we would not shift the burden to the defendant.
Well, I wanted to make sure of that.
It'd still be up to him to raise the issue.
If the jury believes that he did make a retraction, then it's a complete
Yes. Well, if, yes, if he urges that he retracted, then the burden would be on the state in the perjury prosecution to prove that he didn't retract, or that it wasn't in the same proceeding, or something else.
The possibility of having a retraction reducing the degree of to encourage him to at least have some incentive for him to come across with the truth.
You could reduce the perjury to false swearing.
What would you do in false swearing?
But Chairman, it seems that we're going to, in my own mind, anyway, I kind of have to divide the question to whether I think that a retraction statute is the way to go or not. And then at what point in the proceedings a retraction is a defense, in my opinion, at what point whether or not a retraction would absolve you perjury prosecution but leave you open to false swearing, for example, the lesser penalty. And I wonder if that might not be the way to look at the thing. If the commission doesn't feel that there's a principle of retraction is worth including, why then the other questions are moot. If they are, then it seems that we're going to have some other arguments.
In other words, if we're going to reject the
principle of
the principle of retraction at all, there's no point in going any further.
Chairman, maybe just to get things going, I'll just move to delete Section 6. Delete Section 6.
What is the big present law? We have no statutory law on retraction, nor even the bill.
You heard that. Except for news, Roger indicated this would represent the minority view of the United States by a long shot. I mean,
as far as I could find, only four states presently have a retraction statute: Florida, Missouri, New York, and Pennsylvania.
Modern trend.
Missouri, like drugs. Like drugs, you know. The country will adopt it. So.
Nothing wrong with being a leader.
Professor Platt.
Mr. Chairman, we're looking at on this subject by analogy. Subcommittee number 3 has already discussed and passed on the Inculpate Crimes Act, which should reach the commission shortly. And in the Inculpate Crimes article, we are providing for withdrawal from the crimes of attempt, solicitation, and conspiracy. Now, in a sense, perjury is an Inculpate Crime, and that until the actual judgment is entered, the harm hasn't really occurred. The crime of perjury has occurred, and is in that sense complete. Harm that it causes or may tend to cause is still incomplete. I think it's that we ought to think of the retraction as part of the withdrawal provision or withdrawal philosophy of the Inculpate Crimes in general. And I might add that in those Inculpate Crimes, we provided that the burden of the proof, not only did we have the persuasion burden, was on the defendant, as well as the burden of introduction of the issue. That is, the defendant had to introduce the subject of withdrawal from the crime of attempt, conspiracy, or solicitation, and also has to bear the burden of proof on the issue. Now, I don't know whether you want to get into the problem of allocation, but I think that, personally, that retraction would be a beneficial and constructive section to add.
Jake.
I just wanted to add, I think there's the lawyers get too used to trying to punish every bit of immoral conduct. The goal of the criminal law, it seems to me, should not be simply to punish wrongful conduct. When we talk about perjury, particularly, we should think about the broader goal, and that is to ensure the integrity of the trial process. That's really what we're trying to do. People do things they shouldn't do every day, and they don't necessarily outlaw retraction. Laws, even though maybe rare, helps to accomplish that purpose. The only concern that I share is that of that Bob Chandler expressed, that this particular Section 6 is too broad. And I don't know whether it would include retraction, for example, during a motion for new trial or in any stage of the verdict. For that reason, while I favor the idea of helping to ensure the integrity of the trial, I think I prefer the Model Penal Code, Section 241.1, on the next page, which says that the retraction must occur prior to the falsification substantially affecting the proceedings, which I would think could be any time after verdict or finding.
Mr. Chairman? With respect to what Professor Platt said, connected with the court crimes, there was one distinction that we recognized here, and one requirement that was included in that, and that was that this had to be a completely voluntary act on the part of the defendant. He would be allowed to withdraw after he saw that the jig was up and the cops were closing in or something.
That's the way the New York retraction statute reads. It would respect
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate if the Attorney General would withdraw his motion. Because it's, I think it's making it may put some of us in a position we don't particularly want to be in. If he would do so, I'd offer a substitute motion that we approve the principle of the retraction statute received from there.
Would you advise him of what the nature of your substitute motion would be before he...
How about a substitute motion that if it's prior to...
Well, I don't want to get into the question of the time yet, because I think we're going to have another hang-up there, because I happen to agree with Jake's position on the thing, that the way this is drawn the second sentence. I don't like this whole proceeding bit. I want it done at the time that it has an effect and before the guy's caught it.
This is why basically overcomes my principle objection.
Yeah.
All right, well, you wish to withdraw your motion. No on this
motion has been withdrawn.
Oh, well, I move we approve the principle of retraction.
Well, I'd like to inquire, do you want to have the staff work on it some more?
No, not necessarily. He simply wants to know if the commission as a whole approves of the principle of retraction. And if that passes, why then we'll go into this. There shouldn't be any lengthy discussion on that. All those...
Mr. Chairman, before we... Yes.
John,
now you got through 12 sections, and I got. I want to know what the. I'm sorry, I'm late, but I want to know what the subcommittee, what consideration they gave to a retraction statute. Was this discussed by the subcommittee?
Mr. Chairman, this came up as a result of commission discussion last time.
Yeah, it started with subcommittee. We spent 2 hours on it at our last commission meeting.
We referred to the commission. Commission directed the staff to draft a tentative suggested proposal.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carry.
No.
Carry.
I would not box all of that.
Now, Mr. Chandler.
Without hooking myself to the text of the Model Penal Code, the perjury retraction statute, I'd move that we approve that in principle, and if it needs any redrafting to fit our general form and so forth.
Namely that it was retracted in the course of the proceeding in which it was made before it became manifest that the falsification was or would be exposed, and before the falsification substantially affected the proceedings.
Yeah, this business, as I read the draft that we have in front of us, why this would mean that in a sentencing hearing, it could be retracted then. It could be retracted during a motion for new trial. It could be retracted at any point when it really would have affected the outcome. And as I understand what the court's view on this sort of thing, why a guy could go to jail as a result of a
of a perjury and not be freed by the courts on the grounds that the jury should have known the difference. When the chief prosecution witness comes in at a later date and says, I lied.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you, but Roger has pointed out, I think very graphically here, the difficulty that exists with this manifestly and before. When does it affect the outcome or the trial, or when did it become apparent that it was manifest that this would be exposed?
That's my objection, Mr. Chairman, because if you put the burden on the prosecution of proving that the retraction was made after it became manifest that the falsification would be exposed, how does the prosecution go about proving that? Seems to me that's an extremely difficult thing to establish. And even if you did it the other way around, if you put the burden on the defendant, how does he go about proving that it became manifest that the falsification would be exposed? In other words,
it means manifest to him.
Well, now, okay, now, you prove it by showing that it was manifest to the perjurer that he was about to get caught.
Yeah.
Now, how do you do that in your typical perjury situation where the guy's getting ready?
Well, is that more difficult than to prove intent in some of the cases?
It's almost going to require the trial attorney testifying as to what his next few questions were going to be and what the information he had in his file and what he thought the defendant knew, that what rung the bell on him, that he knew that the prosecutor had the goods on him. Because his next question was, this one question was going to lead up to this next question, which in turn would knew that he had it, or the witness knew that the attorney had it on him.
Well,
all kinds of
objectionable
testimony
going to
have to cut
man. Well, yourself, it wouldn't be such a problem if it was the defense, or the defendant and the jury. The burden.
Well, if you mean manifest to the defendant,
that's what it means, isn't it? That's what it means.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Well, that's the only question.
Well, it would have
material.
To be.
It wouldn't be material in
anything else. It's manifest to some newspaper reporter covering it. It doesn't have
some
an effect on
him.
Or DA. DA could have materials in his files, and it would be very manifest to him.
Would we solve this problem or create a greater one by saying the retraction has to be made during the same stage, day, hour, some limited period of the proceedings?
You could say before a decision has been made on a question of fact, which this was material testimony to.
That means before
either
the
by
jury.
Court or jury. That's kind of cumbersome wording. But
even so, I think that it hits a point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you want to hold before the carrot out long enough to purify
yeah.
the process.
Yeah.
That's what you're aiming.
Yeah.
That's
really, what you're trying to do is to make sure that the jury, if it goes to the jury, that the jury, before it starts considering the fact, knows that the witness A or B or whatever it was perjured himself and admitted to it. Isn't it? That's the place that... Now, is there any time before that in the process where the judge is likely to rule on something? I suppose there is.
Yeah, but both judges' rulings could be undone if the...
This would likely to be on
the... If the decision has not yet been made.
Yeah.
Now that, in effect, would be at any stage of the proceeding. It, in effect, is exactly what we have here.
No, what we have here would be on a motion for a new trial and a retrial and everything.
Of course, well, I was referring to statements made in separate hearings or separate stages of the same judicial administrative proceeding.
Now, of course, you see, you've got a number of stages. Take, for example, your workman's comp,
post-conviction stage
situation, where you've got your hearing before the hearing officer, and then some possibility of some testimony at the circuit court stage, and this would run through a number of your administrative proceedings.
But in every one of those stages, a decision would have been made at that time.
Supposing that there's a criminal case, a criminal case being tried, and it's continued by reason of sickness of the defendant, and it resumes a week or a month later.
Then he's got an extra month.
No determination had been made as to any issue of fact.
Well, I don't. In that case, I think that'd be fine. That's what I'm aiming at.
But this goes far beyond that.
But this goes beyond that.
Chairman, it seems to me that really this is a matter of drafting. I think it's going to be a tough draft.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of drafting. We can't do it here. And I think that kind of the aim of everybody here is pretty well expressed. It seems to me we ought to send it back to the staff. Yeah.
Roger, do you get the point?
Give it to Haas.
Well, they can bring it up. They want to limit the time period that the objection can be made. Because I think, for example, Mr. Chairman, that if you have two stages of an administrative proceeding, if the man commits perjury and thus pollutes the initial process, so a decision is reached, then it doesn't seem to me that he ought to get off the hook by retracting in the later stage of it.
That's what Bruce is saying.
I think that's what Bruce is saying.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I think it's difficult to ask the job, but I think it's simply bad.
Well, as I understand the workman's compensation case now under President Seth can go from the commission to the circuit court to the Court of Appeals to the State Supreme Court.
And then back again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to try. I wouldn't want to have everybody go to the State Supreme Court after the Court of Appeals ruled on the matter, if somebody admitted he'd been lying. I don't know how to stop it in administrative. I can see where we can, in criminal proceeding.
Bruce's suggestion would take care of that. Because there would have been a determination on material issue of fact or issue.
You still have a situation, I'd say, in a show cause and temporary custody thing where the judge takes it under advice and has granted a decision.
Yeah.
That still gives him the opportunity that before the judge actually makes a decision to come in and...
And I think that's all right.
Well, at least before he announces it, let's not get into a Haynesworth question.
Oh,
before he announces it, Chairman.
Well, before he announces it, it hasn't really been made. And it's effective.
Oh, all right.
Well, even Bruce's suggestion should say, I would think, before submission to the jury. Once that jury goes out, you can't correct the
error.
Before the decision is made by the court, or
submission to the prior fact.
Jury.
Yeah, I suppose so.
You understand it all right.
If you have any trouble with that, Roger, get a hold of Jake.
Bob Chandler.
Have him send you a draft. No, not Chandler.
Haas.
Haas and Jake.
Or Haas.
Is that all we had on...
I remember the first.
No, we have some other sections yet to consider.
Oh yeah, that's right. We only got your first five.
We'll have to remember all section six, section seven now. Turn the book. A new section six.
No, we're on side. Yeah,
section seven. Page 38, 32. Aren't we? Fiction readers. We finished five last month.
Yes, that's right. Page 32.
Now we got to read number 6 and 7.
Page 32. Page 32. Yes, the original section. Please take that. All right, Don. Page 32.
Section 6. Perjury and false swearing. Corroboration required. In any prosecution for perjury or false swearing, except the prosecution based upon inconsistent statements pursuant to Section 7, falsity of a statement may not be established solely through contradiction by testimony of a single witness. This, in effect, we
so long now.
Existing Oregon law.
Move it. Read number section 7 and approve it.
Is there any further discussion?
If you have one witness that can testify to the whole issue, you know, proving that what the guy said was a lie, you've only got one witness. And yet if you've got two or three witnesses that pick up little issues that go through circumstantially, you might say that it's a lie. You've got a case and you need to go to the jury on. But yet the one witness that right there with the defendant and saw what he did, so knew that he was lying, isn't good enough. I think you get a police officer in the area, I think it's good enough to go to the jury. It seems kind of inconsistent, really, because sometimes the one witness can be much stronger than two or three witnesses.
You're thinking of a situation where a witness says, I never saw nor signed such a letter. Another witness comes up, and here it is.
Well,
you don't have to have two witnesses.
That's what that seems to say.
You've got to have two witnesses or one witness in corroborating circumstances so that you can go to the. Of course, like with your situation, you could probably come up with a handwriting expert or something to make yourself two witnesses. Least corroborating circumstances.
Well, even worse, supposing that you only have one witness, you don't have any handwriting experts, and then he says, yes, I did.
It's the present law, but it's what the present law is. There were very few perjury prosecutions.
Now, this section had an interesting course in model penal code because their advisory committee recommended against it. They were supported by the council. It's only the model penal code reporters that supported it, and they finally prevailed.
Well, suppose you had just a letter. He says, I didn't send a letter. You have a letter and put it on it.
The reason why they want more than one witness because you just don't want the perjury prosecution to come down to the word of two people, the defendant and one telling the truth and one other person saying no, he's lying. And,
perjury charges legal machine could result in perjury charges.
Well, everything considered, isn't it better to have the requirement of at least two witnesses to corroborate this rather than try to isolate and segregate all the various factual situations and cases that can come up and say in this type of a case, one is enough, in this type it isn't? If we're going to err, isn't it better to err on the side of requiring two or more?
Well, this doesn't say it requires two witnesses.
Well, it seemed to me, Mr. Chairman, we ought to make it clear that as I read the commentary, however, this essentially wouldn't change the existing law in Oregon.
No, it's been the law since Blackstone.
And you qualify that, you say it's
well, in other words, you need one witness plus corroborating circumstances, or you need two witnesses. And that's what the law is in Oregon, and as I read this draft, this draft wouldn't change that basic notion.
I don't think it does.
Does the present law,
is that right?
That's right.
Does the present law relate to false swearing as well as perjury?
No, it doesn't.
All right, so this broadens it. Can you prove false swearing by one witness now?
You can now. Apparently so, because the statute of corroboration only refers to perjury, not to false swearing.
I wondered if there was any reason why you used a statement that in the testimony.
Oh, you mean in Section 6? Well, because Section 6, as originally drafted, was not drafted in the same form it is now, and in subcommittee, they recommended that we adopt the Michigan language, which is on page 37, verbatim, in effect. So that is what form it's in now. They use the term statement.
Well, and we've got statement defined, too, in the definition section. Well, this would only change the law to the extent that it would require two witnesses in false swearing as well as perjury, whereas up to now we've only required two witnesses in perjury.
I just didn't see any rational basis for distinguishing between perjury and false swearing.
I think you're right.
Using statement, it would mean a sworn statement too.
As it's used here. Well, since we're referring both to perjury, since we're referring to perjury and false swearing, we're only referring to a sworn statement. It would have to be a sworn statement before you could predicate the charge of perjury.
Sure. Because under 2 and 3, perjury and false swearing are defined as false statements, false sworn statements.
Yes, there's a motion that this be approved.
Question.
As written.
Call the roll.
Fishburne.
Aye.
Senator.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Ross. Cause.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Fawley.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Now, do you want to go in with number 7?
Section 7 on page 38. Perjury and false swearing, inconsistent statements. If we don't presently have a statute on this in Oregon, and in fact, my research would indicate it's probably contrary to case law in Oregon. If a person has made sworn statements, both being made within the statute of limitations and within the jurisdiction of this state, it shall not be necessary to allege an indictment or allegation which statement is false. It shall be sufficient to set forth the inconsistent sworn statements and allege in the alternative that one or the other is false and that the defendant knowingly made the false statement. Sub 2. The highest offense of which a person may be convicted is determined by hypothetically assuming each statement to be false. If perjury and false swearing could be established by the making of the two statements, a person may be convicted only of false swearing.
Explain that again.
The highest offense of which a person may be convicted is what you mean under this section.
Yes.
What you're saying is that you can convict only on the lower of two offenses.
Lesser
of two offenses.
Your presumption is that he's telling the truth will carry the highest.
You presume that he told the truth in the worst case.
Yeah. This section was advanced by the Model Penal Code, and it has been accepted by New York, Michigan, and New Jersey.
What he means by hypothetically assuming each statement is false. Who's going to assume that?
Do you need to use the word by hypothetically?
safely assuming each statement is to be false? Can you just say by assuming each statement to be false? Which perhaps you'd have the same effect term hypothetically as you, because at the time you make the assumption you don't know.
Yeah. Well, I see some problems with this language, Mr. Chairman. And that is, is this going to affect the name, for example, that you put on the indictment? Suppose you got an indictment, you allege two inconsistent statements. And does the prosecutor put on the top of the indictment perjury, or does he put on false swearing? Secondly, in instructing the jury and in submitting verdict forms, do you then make the determination? And finally, of course, would be the question of the penalty to be imposed, assuming we have different penalties for perjury and false swearing. And I think you're going to have problems. Who makes the hypothetical assumptions, and at what stage, and on what basis? In other words, if you, as I understand it, the difference between perjury and false swearing here would be retained. That is, it's one, it's material, and the other, it isn't. And how the person drawing the hypothetical assumption, at the time he draws that assumption, is he fully aware of all the background sufficiently to enable him to do so?
How would you instruct under this?
Damn if I know. That's why I'm raising this question.
Also, if you have a situation where you've got the two inconsistent statements, one be perjury, one be false swearing, the state, say you don't know whether you charge perjury or false swearing, because it depends on whether the court rules that that other statement is material or not to make it perjury. So you charge them with perjury. Then you go ahead and put on proved by other witnesses to prove that the perjury statement was actually the false one, but yet the jury could fall back on the judge could be expected.
But he said the prosecutor should have alleged the false one. That was the false one. If he had that proof.
Well, but
not going under this thing.
But. In other words, suppose.
Well, but what if you don't know for sure you're going to be able to prove that that's false? So you want to at least be able to get him on the through the other. Would that mean then that it's like the felony murder? I mean, you can let your premeditation and get the instruction on the felony murder.
Let us take, for example, just to use a simple example, suppose the fellow gets on the witness stand in a fender bender and says the light was red. And then the next day on rebuttal, he says the light was green. Now, in the usual case, that statement would either be material or non-material. It would be as material on Tuesday as it was on Wednesday, or as non-material. And yet, you couldn't really tell the materiality of it until you had examined the whole case. In each instance. Furthermore, suppose the prosecutor thinks that it's material and the court ultimately tells him no, it wasn't material in that particular instance.
He better fall back on the section 6. Tell the truth somewhere else.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really have some question in my mind as to whether or not we really need a section like this. This is a new thing in our law, and I'm not so sure that the difficulties in perjury prosecution have been so great as to call for this kind of a relaxation of the requirements for proving your case. I don't know.
I've had situations where I've had this, and I knew that they were lying, and I couldn't do anything about it. Because you knew that they'd lied once, but
you didn't know
which time. And you just sit there and everybody's calling out, well, that guy's a perjurer. And you say, well, sure, I know he is. One time or the other he is, but which time?
No, I think there's merit to the thing. But I don't, certainly you can retrieve some of it, even though the jury would only convict of the lesser crime, Volkswagen, if they could be sure which one it was. They usually would take the lesser one.
Well, the question of whether this is material or that's I understand the difference between perjury and false swearing. Yeah. It's going to be told to the jury by the judge, isn't it?
I don't know whether the judge would usually
materiality has to be proved.
And it's a jury question, isn't it?
You have testimony by a judge who heard the testimony or whatever, saying it wasn't material.
Well, but under the definition section, it's a matter of law whether or not it's a given statement of material.
That's a change.
Well, under our section one of this draft,
it would be a question. That's the way that the judge is probably instructing. It's a matter of law.
That's what I'm saying. The judge is going to be able to say, as I read this, to the jury before they go out, statement A was material to the thing, statement B was not material, so as a result, the highest crime which you find this man guilty is false swearing. Now, if you believe that those are the facts, one by bringing a verdict.
Well, I take it in under a prosecution under this section, all you do is introduce the two statements, statement of rest.
About all this is going to happen.
That'd make a prima facie case, at least. They wouldn't answer it.
And that's where I get it. I'm supposed to go ahead and call what he's asking.
It seems to me, if you adopt a section like this, I think it's a good idea. You should build into it an exception to the Section 6 situation of recantation. Because they're squarely in conflict.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, you should build into it an exception to the corroboration requirement of the two witness rule. Because who knows? This could be proved by one court reporter who reported two trials.
Where the guy might be indicted on his two inconsistent statements. And his defense would be, yeah, but that second inconsistent statement
was the retraction rather than the...
But if you leave the recantation section the way it presently is, namely that the burden is on the state, have you really made any change in the state's problems? You say now, the trouble is, the guy says one day the light is red, the next day he says the light is green, and you're stuck. You can't do anything about it, and yet you know he's lying. But
then he can recant and say, I didn't mean it was
but
green.
But all he does,
red.
All he does is say, well, I recanted.
And then to save himself on what the other possibility, you turn around and
lied when I recanted, actually it was green.
Well, he says, my best recollection is that it was red.
I'm colorblind.
Why not make Section 7 applicable only where the sworn statements are in different
proceedings? Well, I do away with most of it.
So, what about where you've got the situation where really it isn't a retraction? If we adopt the rule that, if when he's going to be found out, he comes out with the truth, it's not really a retraction, like, say, under cross-examination, theoretically breaks down and comes across with the truth, then, or at least what appears to be the truth, but you're still faced with problems with proving it, it wouldn't be a retraction because he was just about going to be found out.
Manifest that
it was manifest that he was going to be discovered, and yet you should be able to use that. If you're going to indict for perjury, you should be able to use those two sworn statements to meet there.
I see that though as a recantation situation. Now, regarding cross-examination, admits the truth, prosecutes for perjury after he's convicted.
But you don't know whether my statement is the truth or whether it wasn't.
Well, I'm having a hard time with this thing because as I understand it, my impression of a retraction is the guy says, well, before we go any further, I want to say I lied yesterday or this morning or whatever. And just the mere fact that he had made two inconsistent statements, as I want to read it anyway, he wouldn't be able to go in and say, well, the first statement was a lie and the second statement was correct, so therefore that was my retraction of the first one.
Well, I think he could take that position.
But that's not what
I think your understanding is correct.
I don't think we want it.
How badly do we need something like this? I think it's Judge Burns.
I think you need it pretty badly. Yeah,
we need it.
Situations where, as you said, obviously one statement or the other is false, and you can't prove which one. But the fact that he was said to do diametrically opposed things should prove a case, and right there.
Now, this is the same thing about having the material for them.
Well, it to be perjury.
Difference in whether it's perjury or false swear. Well, it
would have to be.
But under the seven, if one of them isn't material, then the highest they can convict of would be false swear.
Of course, it's difficult to imagine a situation in which you had inconsistent statements and that one would be material and the other would not. It's hard to see. He asked him, was it raining or was it dry? And he says, no, it was raining one time. The next time he said the sun was shining.
Yeah, but as Jake says, it could be two different trials over the same, including some of the same facts. In one case material and the other not.
Yeah. This could, well, you'd sure eliminate a lot of the use for such a statute if you limited it to that.
Oh, yeah.
On a non-legal basis, this thing kind of scares me from the standpoint. First of all, I don't think there's that much of a problem with Jim Burns. Secondly, I think that you're putting a pretty powerful tool in the hands of the prosecutor who, especially company, of course, accepted. He generally says, well, we lost the case because so-and-so lied, or he told the grand jury something and came out to trial and changed the story. I think we'll open this thing wide open for a quick conviction of somebody that bad process of life or anything. I think the balancing of that evil against the good it's going to do falls in the area of balancing in favor of evil.
Chairman?
John?
Aside from the point that Dave is making, what about the situation in a typical civil case where you have somebody that comes in for a deposition and the attorney forgets to go over the facts with them before they take the deposition, and the accident was a year or 18 months ago, and he testifies on the deposition, and then between that time and the trial, and the attorney and possibly some of the other witnesses sit down and reconstruct the accident with the witness, he realizes that he unwittingly testified falsely in the deposition.
Then he goes back to section 6 and says, I made a mistake in the deposition, and and so forth.
Yeah,
it
was an error.
Swore upon.
Well, I just wonder, in the hands of an undiscriminating district attorney, if we're not going to be proliferating prosecutions.
Well, I think there are more prosecutions necessary for it than there are. I don't think there are enough of them.
Well, one thing you see very typically in civil cases is the plaintiff forgets some doctor that he's been to. And really, many times, purely unintentional. I'm sure sometimes it's actually intentional. He's trying to pull a fast one. But it's the typical way in which plaintiffs are impeached in civil cases. They say they went to Dr. A, B, and C in a deposition, and then at the trial, it turns out they went to Dr. B as well. And many times you just know that it wasn't an intentional falsehood.
Bruce, would there be a crime committed under this if in taking a deposition with respect to a personal injury action, the witness says, well, the light was red, and there isn't any, no cross-examination, there isn't any discussion about a particular, he simply said it was red at this time, related to the story. Then at the time of trial, he said, well, the light was green. And the opposing counsel says, well, now, didn't you say in your deposition, well, I don't know if I said that, perhaps I did, but I've thought about this a great deal, and I know positively that light was green. Is there a crime committed under this?
No, if he's telling the truth.
Well,
he'd be indictable.
That's what I mean. Would he be indictable?
Sure,
that's what I mean.
And he'd have to defend under
circumstances.
In the situation you're talking about, though, you're talking about deposition to trial. There's no decision made on a deposition, so that his testimony in the trial, rather than being two inconsistent statements, here his second one say, well, if I said that, I was mistaken, and it is green, I'm positive it's green, so it would be a recanting from his saying it was red.
What if he forgot in the course of the trial and the counsel didn't pick it up until he was reading the transcript of the trial that there were inconsistent statements? Are you putting the burden on him to come forward in the first instance when he's called as a witness in the trial to say, incidentally, I made a mistake when I testified in the deposition?
Well, he's assuming that he was honestly mistaken in the
under Tony's hypothetical, you could take the deposition and the trial testimony over the DA and get an indictment like that.
I don't see why you couldn't under this.
Sure, and then the only salvation a guy would have would be this retraction statute. He'd be indicted and you'd have to prosecute him, and there you go. And some of them would get off and some of them wouldn't.
Sure, if you hadn't come forward, sir.
That's exactly, yes, Dave.
Another point, too, is this is a little different, I think, than the usual perjury situation. We have only one statement that can really sway justice if it's actually perjury. Here we're talking about two inconsistent statements which are apparently known at the time of trial. I think we all know a witness who has made inconsistent statements is pretty well shot down as far as the brass anyway. We have the instruction that says if you find the witness falls apart, you can find distrust the balance of testimony. I don't think that the need for this is really apparent, like it is perjury.
We all know
about the girlfriend who goes in, the guy picked up for armed robbery, and the case is either tried separately, and the girlfriend goes in and testifies one thing in one case and one thing in another. This is really what we're aiming at.
Yeah, but you can destroy her at least on one of them as far as the credibility.